Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
Tyler, we just finished watching Dynamite and Kenny Omega against Wheeler Yuta headlined, but I think our top talking point should be Adam Cole and MJF, a burgeoning friendship with all kinds of directions this could go, good and bad, storyline-wise. I'm enjoying it. I'm not ready to like just say they're hitting every note possible at this point. I think my main takeaway is I'm guardedly entertained and along for the ride, but I think it's important that Adam Cole does not in the end look like he was gullible enough to believe that there's a sincere, trustworthy bone in MJF's body. And the question is he playing MJF or is he succumbing to MJF's charm? So that's my kind of a topic. I want to get your take on my take, and then I'll find out what your take is.
Yeah, I'm in a similar vein. I'm in the zone tonight, especially more so with the video than the segment, because I think we'll talk about that in detail, as I think it's the most newsworthy thing or important thing coming out of the show. But I'm entertained. I'm enjoying my time with both these characters. It's kind of like, watching if you're watching a movie and you have two characters that share two or three scenes together and those are your favorite scenes in the movie. That's what this feels like to me. But just like you, I am concerned at where these characters are, right? That's kind of an overall theme of AEW the last couple weeks post Forbidden Door, is I feel like the framing of a lot of these characters is muddled and not in a way that I feel like is going to pay off for every single character. So, you know, tonight having the strategy of MJF being cheered profusely and having Adam Cole do heelish things that MJF has goaded him into is not the greatest long-term trajectory for both these characters. I don't think it's going to go there, but you know, I just don't think AEW has earned the right to make me feel like for sure I know what both these characters are going to end up doing, and it's going to be fulfilling and it's going to work, or it's going to be down the middle and in the end be kind of confusing and ineffective. And you know, what is the case there? So I'm enjoying it, but I am cautious about where this goes. And you know, if Adam Cole made the one wish tonight and it's to get a title shot and that gets brought up, and that all makes more sense. But, you know, are you going to bring up a wish you had on a birthday cake from a segment 3 weeks prior to get a title match? That seems less than ideal for where this feud is. And
I know.
So that's where we are. I enjoy it. I think MJF's having fun. So is Adam Cole, and they're both good at what they do. But it feels like more so we're on the empty calories aspect of this feud or storyline than the full nutritional kale and broccoli salad that should be eating with these two caliber individuals. So again, I don't hate it. I don't want to come across that way. Had a lot of fun with it, but I am concerned long term where this goes.
Don't steal my junk food and kale and general food analogies. That's my territory. You take out your own. I like MJF is very versatile, and he this is a type of thing that I think he enjoys doing. The question is it the right thing for a heel world champion who by the way, he's credible in the ring, and there's a lot of people, Jason Paul was talking about this a few weeks back on the flagship, and he's written about it. You know, do enough people see the pay-per-views to know how good MJF is in the ring? And should they do something about that so that he's got more credibility and people aren't just watching him to be amused, but they're watching him because they see him as a credible top heel, even if he cheats to win. And ultimately the story is, you know, the story you want to tell is baby faces are better if not for the cheating, at least the top tier ones. That's where the heat comes from. Until the announcers extinguish it by praising Wheeler Yuta for attacking Kenny Omega from behind before the bell. Oh man. It's a case of like, you know, I don't think MJF just wants to cut heel promos every week. But I'm not sure that's not the best thing for AEW in some ways. And maybe I'm wrong, you know, but I'm not sure. MJF being a consistently despicable heel who kind of just resists the urge to be entertaining in a more zany DX skit way or a KO Chris Jericho best friendship thing way. I don't know. Like I'm struggling with that a little because he worked so hard and it was so effective in getting people to boo him again. And so here tonight, he's doing things and the fans are chanting his name. Do we have any devil worshippers in the building? And he's going back to that. Now, you know, in the end, he's almost, you know, I mean, I feel like I don't need a qualifier. He's going to be a heel. He's going to be proved to be a distrustful villain and despicable. And the question is, can Adam Cole look like he wasn't an utter fool by not keeping that in mind and knowing that was the end game here? So I still think that's where we're headed. But in the meantime, you know, last time he danced with fans' cheers, they liked it and kept cheering him, and it took a lot of work to get that reversed. So, like I said, just kind of some mixed feelings, but part of it is this is a work in progress. I didn't think the weightlifting thing worked great. You know, oh, spot me. Oh, no, I'm going to look at my phone. So the reason you spot someone is so that, like, the barbell doesn't land on their neck and kill them, and we're supposed to be delighted in the fact that Cole was so easily distracted. And then MJF starts picking on an overweight guy at the gym. You know, every overweight guy's nightmare is going to a gym and being judged like those, like MJF was. But then Cole joined in and took Tony Schiavone down with him. It was a funny line. Schiavone is not svelte. But is it worth it to have Cole share a laugh with MJF that is fat-shaming somebody or making fun of somebody behind their back? Was the punchline worth it? So, I have mixed feelings. I wish I could just be like, this is fine, everyone needs to relax, or this is terrible and it's undercutting both characters. I just have mixed feelings, and I guess my conclusion is I still want to be open-minded and along for the ride, but there are some concerns I had at the beginning, and I still have them after tonight.
Yeah, I would agree. And on that whole Cole thing, especially in the gym video, you know, the story to me that they seem to be telling is, you know, Cole is being tempted, corrupted by his kind of heelish tendencies that we saw when he first entered AEW by MJF, who, you know, is self-proclaimed the devil. But, you know, in wrestling in general, not just AEW, but those like bigger nuanced stories of a character who is a good guy and is being tempted to be a bad guy and does a couple bad guy things and then ultimately comes around and is the hero and you know, dismisses that is a hard story to tell in the format. And week by week, and AEW certainly hasn't done that well. You know, the most other ambitious story on this front would be the Adam Page, you know, kind of anxiety, the drinking thing that kind of didn't, it popped in and out and it was hard to follow. And I'm sure there's people listening to this that could defend that whole storyline start to end and tell you how it was a beautiful tapestry of, you know, anxiety and overcoming that to be the champion. But, you know, I didn't get that as clear as some other people did. So, It just seems like I see what they're doing, and I respect the attempt to, you know, expand the art form. I think that's kind of more of an MJF thing to kind of tell a story like that. But I just don't think it's going to hit in the end. It's going to be, you know, something in the ring where they're in the finals against somebody and Cole decides to be a good guy and MJF's mad that they didn't win because of that. And then it kind of devolves into the wrestling thing. And that's where things like this in hindsight are weird when inevitably you have, you know, MJF screwing over Cole or vice versa for them not to win. And then we get to their feud and all that, and it feels a little bit more wrestling formulaic. And and in the end, it's like, what was Cole's character doing here? Is he totally redeemed by just choosing not to join MJF in the end? Like, that's not a super powerful story if you were to frame that in another context. So we'll see.
Yeah. No, I think you hit on a lot of the key points and concerns going into this. I think Cole having being heel in the past and then being kind of pulled back into that realm is something that has potential. They need to be careful with it. And I think part of what makes it work or not work, and I alluded to it earlier, Wheeler Yuta attacks Kenny Omega before the bell. And then the ref ridiculously rewards the heel attack by calling for the bell instead of checking on whether Omega's fine and making sure that attack isn't rewarded. I harp on this, but I harp on it for a reason, because it's really stupid that they do this. And then you have Taz, which is fine, saying, I think it's a good strategy. Wheeler's got to do what he can. To me, the heat's on the ref, not Wheeler. If the ref's going to ring the bell, then Yuta's a fool to not attack. Everybody's a fool to not attack their opponent before the bell if the ref is going to just call for the bell and make that the start of a match. But then Tony Schiavone goes, I agree with you, Taz. You got to do what you got to do. And it's like, Wheeler, you're just going for heel heat. Don't take out the fire extinguisher and spray it down. You've got Tony Schiavone, this super likable guy who the fans adore, going, yeah, Wheeler, you're just totally right to do that. Now, if Schiavone had said, and I'm on a different topic, but it sort of relates. If Schiavone had said, hey, that's not – you. What kind of pride can Yuta have in winning? But you know what? If Yuta thinks that's the only way he can win, I guess I see why he took that chance at getting disqualified. And then Schiavone should go, what's the ref doing calling for the bell? You know, I mean, it's just – it's a whole thing. And, I, you know, people go, oh, no one's thinking about that. Well, right, but the effect of it wears away at the ability to have the crowd get wrapped up in what's happening. And they wouldn't do it if it wasn't to get heel heat. And so why do that? So that gets to the Cole thing. If Cole is doing all these things that are sort of, oh, I'll hold your hand for extra leverage, MJF, and I'll make fun of the fat guy. Isn't it funny that there's a guy who's trying to get in shape and he's really big and we're going to make – if he does that, part of what makes this story work is how the announcers react to it. Mm-hmm. You know, how do they as the narrators of the story frame it? And if they're like – well, you know, Cole's finally learning. You got to do what you got to do to win. Well, it completely ruins everything. But if the announcers go, what is Cole doing? We know he's got a past. He's been trying to move away from this, taking shortcuts. He doesn't need to do this. MJF's a bad influence. You know, what's happening? If that is the story they're telling, it's important for the announcers to emphasize and frame things in a way that does help lead the story in that direction. How did you think they did tonight, especially during the match?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you that I don't think it was done well, and I think that's always kind of been a weak point with the announced team, and especially you mentioned, you know, Taz is your heel-ish commentator, Excalibur is your straight man, and then who leans into being the more babyface, and then Tony Schiavone says whatever he wants to say, and it's kind of just written off as being the case, and yeah, I mean, I think it's the same way, and the match tonight with Cole and MJF and then the post-match stuff is more just reactions and not framing it in that way whatsoever. And, you know, it doesn't also help. I'm not sure how your feed is, but I feel like the sound mixing since the beginning of AEW has always been pretty poor for me, at least on the announcers. And
I was wondering if that was just me and my sound bar, because I'm having to turn on closed captioning to even know what the announcers are saying, because the crowd is mic'd way too loud compared to the announcers.
Yeah, so that's the same thing for me. So I can hear Taz usually all the time, Excalibur when he's, you know, loud, but Tony Schiavone kind of gets blended out for me. So, you know, it's you know, I said the good thing about you and I both doing reports is that I think you're a lot heavier on the commentators and how they frame things, and I'm more so on, you know, the play-by-play stuff. But, yeah, I would say not framed well, to answer your question in a long format.
Yeah, and I – cover the announcers because I think they're an essential part of the storytelling, you know, I think announcers can enhance or undercut anything that's happening. And plus, you know, they deliver news during commentary. So definitely I think it's good, you know, that I'm fitting that in and maybe covering fewer of the moves that are happening, but trying to hit the key turning points in the written report. And it is one of the reasons we try to have multiple TV reports, because it's just valuable. Different things stand out to different people who are covering the show. But yeah, the announcing is really essential. And sometimes just being, well, whatever. I mean, sometimes just hitting mute, you would end up with more of the intent of the wrestlers than if you had the announcers on. And this is historical, and WWE, it's been an issue. I think announcers sometimes undercut what's happening, and other times I think they really help what's happening. And so anyway, there's lots of examples of that. But let's stay focused here on Dynamite. And in fact, let's pause. Let's briefly introduce ourselves in the show, and then we'll get to callers. We got Chris from Mount Pearl, Newfoundland up first, and others on hold. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Wednesday, July 5th, 2023. And I'm Wade Keller, the host of the show, the editor, publisher, and founder of the Pro Wrestling Torch Weekly Newsletter and the website pwtorch.com, and the host of various podcasts, VIP exclusive and free. This is one of our free ones, although it is presented without commercials for our VIP members on our VIP podcast feed. And tomorrow on our Blue Logo Show, the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, as opposed to this, the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show, Todd Martin will be my co-host on the Flagship. It'll be a simulcast of the VIP show, The Fix, and we're going to cover all kinds of current events. So hit download on that on Thursday night. The one of our best of editions we just put up from 10 years ago yesterday is a really good historical show with George Shire. Bruce Mitchell joined me as co-host. George Shire, longtime friend of mine, co-host on my early 1990s radio show on KFAN, the weekly pro wrestling radio show. And we talked about the history of world championships from the 1950s through the 2010s. It is, I think, essential listening if you're interested in the history of pro wrestling. It's George is a great radio guy, and Bruce added so much to it. So I point people towards that. Don't wait for the Flagship to show up Thursday night. I'd carve out some time for that that history piece. I was inspired by 10 years ago on July 4th, Vince McMahon. I think it was July 4th. Vince McMahon just throwing the battle between the world champ and the WWE champ on TV with no notice. And I was just appalled. And I'm like, all right, we need to talk about world champions. And I called up George. I'm like, let's do a special show. So anyway, the other voice here on the show so far is Tyler Sage. He is a PW Torch contributor and part of the PW Torch YouTube channel and written reports for AEW Dynamite and more. And he is a regular voice here on the post shows. Tyler, welcome back to the co-host chair.
Hey, good to be here as always, and kind of a ho-hum night, I think, of Dynamite, but I'm excited to talk about all the stuff that happened.
Yeah, yeah, I think there's enough. There's certainly some other topics that we can explore, and we'll do so with callers. Speaking of which, if you are live streaming the show, you are encouraged to call us and push one, and then you can be part of our conversation tonight. The number to call is 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558, and when you call, push 1. You can also email us if that works better for you, especially if you can't live stream the show and you just listen later on demand, downloading the show in the morning, for instance. You can email us your thoughts on any of the shows we cover, Raw, Dynamite, SmackDown, and Collision, and that email address is wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. I do want to note, if you are a Stitcher user, they announced last week they're shutting Stitcher down. SiriusXM owns Stitcher there as a subsidiary. They're shutting it down at the end of August. So if you do listen to us on a Stitcher app, you're going to want to move all your podcasts, including ours, to another app between now and then. So just giving you a heads up. So, you know, it could be a headline that flies under the radar, although I know Stitcher's putting alerts up on their website. But we have a lot of listeners through Stitcher, and we want to give you fair warning to switch over to another podcast app. Many good ones out there. All right. Let's go first to Chris from Mount Pearl, Newfoundland. Chris, welcome to the show. Good to talk to you again. What stood out on Dynamite tonight for you?
Gentlemen, good evening. How are we doing?
Good, good.
I thought it was pretty brave of the Acclaimed to start off by talking about Trudeau in Alberta. For those of you not familiar with the Canadian political climate, Alberta is basically Texas, and Trudeau is basically on the left. So that was pretty risky, but I guess they were attacking him, so it was fine. I want to start with this blind eliminator tournament. I really, really want to hate it, because the last time I remember them doing anything like this in any company was when we had Test and D'Lo Brown competing for the tag team championships at a WrestleMania randomly because they won a battle royal. And we all know how wonderfully that turned out, that well-known tag team. But it's just, they've done so many cool things with these pairings. Yes, some of them are a little too convenient, but I think we're going to see something with the combined age of 105 of Jeff Jarrett and Matt Hardy. We're seeing the Swerve and Keith Lee angle getting resurrected. We're going to see Darby and Orange Cassidy continue their team up. I was reminded that Matt Sydal has a job. I'm really enjoying this, the way that they've put this together. And what is the end game with it, do you think?
Yeah. First of all, Tyler, there are two parts there. The end game, we'll get to that. Also, the convenience of, say, Garcia and Guevara getting drawn as partners. You know, the Matt Hardy, Jeff Jarrett thing is fine in terms of it feels genuinely random. I hope they call themselves Team 105 or something like that. The 105 Express, the I don't know, Centurion, I don't know. We can come up with our
Centurion Guard or something.
Yes. But really, it was, you know, Swerve and Strickland, convenient. Garcia and Guevara convenient. Everything else so far is relatively random. So, I mean, if there's just one odd couple team and one existing faction team, am I missing anything? I don't have anything in front of me. Is there anything else that's overly convenient?
No, not really that I can think of. I mean, you know, the fact that the world champion and Adam Cole got the easiest team too, but
yeah.
You know.
That was too, yeah, no, actually that was super convenient because they just had their draw and then they just happened to have an in-ring segment and right before that they just happened to have their names drawn. So that I knew there was a little bit more, you know, aspect of it was just a little too convenient. I think pro wrestling fans are willing to a lot for certain things like that in a certain quantity. And if it stops now, they're pushing it, but if it serves storyline purposes, I mean, I guess, you know, we can accept it with some reservations, and I think fans will too. So there is that aspect of it. But, I mean, at least the convenient pairings have a storyline basis to them. So, Tyler, talk more about that if you want. And then also, where do you think this is headed? Is it headed all the way to Cole and MJF in the finals against someone? And if so, whom and who wins and what happens next?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, have we seen a bracket for this thing? I know we just got teams announced tonight, so I don't think we have, but that would help to kind of formulate where it's going to go. But I still think I have a guess. But, for the tournament itself, I like it in a vacuum because AEW is taking it as serious as they need to, where this is a, you know, like any good gimmick, the Royal Rumble or Money in the Bank at WWE as an example, that – you know, the best part of the Royal Rumble, besides getting a main event for WrestleMania, is that you tell, you know, you get two or three matches out of that event, hopefully. And that's a good use of a gimmick to tell stories out of it. And I think this event, the blind tag tournament is telling multiple stories and getting meaningful stories for people that we haven't seen, you know, for a long time, Keith Lee being kind of resurrected tonight or an attempt to do that. And then, you know, Garcia and Sammy. So all that works well and AEW's not taking it too seriously. I personally, as a viewer, am more locked into this blind tag tournament than the Owen tournament. So having both of those going on at the same time is not super helpful for, you know, tournaments as a positive, having them all the time. But for the tournament itself, I certainly see the writing on the wall right now would be MJF and Cole taking on Darby and Orange Cassidy in the final. And then, you know, right there, like we talked about in the cold open, Cole having to make the decision to, you know, do heelish things to be two super baby faces and what his decision is and where the story goes from there. Ultimately, him choosing to be a good guy and pissing off MJF, I think, would be the story to tell there. If that's the case, super good use of the tournament. And not that that's the only way that works for me. Obviously, that's not the case. But, you know, that would be a successful tournament and get lots of stories out of it for that way. So, yeah, I think it's been positive. The Owen tournament feels lesser as a result for me personally, but I think it's been a fun time and a good way to fill TV time as well.
Chris, back to you.
Yeah. First of all, I was 7 days off being a year out. So there are actually only 103 combined age, Matt and Jeff. But Jeff Jarrett's birthday is next week. So it'll be 104 then. So I'm not far off. I actually think Tyler, you've hit it bang on the head with the finals. I would go a step further and say, I can see whoever gets the pin, it might just be on MJF, like either Darby or Orange, and that sets up like a follow-up feud for MJF coming out of that. So you could go that way as well. But, you know, there's a lot to it. We also don't know how many teams are even in this, let alone haven't seen a bracket yet. So we could be here for a little while.
Yeah.
But I want to cut them a break because it's not like AEW ever runs tournaments. This is a rarity for them. So we'll give them a little, slack on that one. All right, let's flip to the obligatory women's match. I keep hearing people say how Ruby Soho is really good in the ring and Britt's improving in the ring, and I've never seen evidence of either of those statements. 2 years ago, roughly, I was on the show and we were talking about Britt Baker's super kicks and how she should really just not do them, and nope, she's still doing them, and nope, she's still not good at them. What is it going to take to get some good women's matches on this show regularly? You can't have Toni Storm wrestling every week. And they do have the talent. You've got Willow Nightingale. Serena Deeb is allegedly still employed. I don't know where she is. But they're running this one match out there a week, maybe two if you have another one on Collision. That's not time enough for anybody to get better. What's it going to take to get this women's division up to a point where there aren't just botches left, right, and center?
It's a good question. You're not wrong. It was, I mean, I thought there were aspects of the match, a minority of minutes were good. Never very good. And the majority of minutes of the match had things that were clunky or botchy or dangerous looking. And that's not good. It just isn't. And you're right in your observation. You know, Britt Baker, what's going to take is for wrestlers who aren't very good, who aren't as smooth in the ring, who aren't smooth in the ring to not get big reactions from fans. That's part of it. Because, you know, Britt Baker just got really over and she was not injured, and they've been riding that ever since. But, yeah, I mean, it's hard to match up really polished wrestling with a really polished character. And AEW is not, after all these years, hasn't really come up with a strong women's division where everything just kind of seems in sync. And, you know, Britt Baker still talks about being the king of or the queen or whatever, the leader of that women's division. But, you know, her matches, you know, aren't typically as good as most of the other top tier women and what they're able to produce. Not that she hasn't had good matches, but yeah, Ruby and Britt today was clunky. Tyler, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think all that's on the nose. And I also think it's, you know, a time commitment. And, you know, am I saying there should be three men's matches, three women's matches every Dynamite? No, but, you know, let's say we take, I don't know, what was the, I'm trying to think of a match tonight, you know, but if a random Wardlow match is the only men's match and there are five women's matches, I think the spotlight would be on the men's division for like, really, this is, of all the people we have on the roster, this is the one match we get a week, and that will then, you know, affect your opinion of that entire division. Because, you know, if you're only watching Dynamite and you're, let's say you're watching Collision on DVR and you're not watching Rampage, then this is all you're seeing for a whole week from the AEW women's division. That kind of skews the division in a negative way. And then anyone in a women's match in AEW has to climb even higher to get above that standard. And when you have more bites at the apple, just the division and your perceived value of your skill on the roster is amplified. So, and I would agree tonight, you know, every time I see Britt wrestle recently, I'm thinking, is she injured? Because there's not a lot's happening and it's not super smooth. And that's kind of always been her MO. So I think you're on the nose there, Wade, with fans not getting people over that are not super skilled would be super helpful. But also just AEW having commitment to that being a focus of either you're going to have good matches or you're going to have good laid out matches. And this was neither. I mean, this whole match was based on five or six heel spots, just kind of doing the same thing over and over again. And as a viewer, you're just like, okay, I know what the finish is going to be. And I know there's a baby face waiting in the tournament. So I know what's going to happen here. And, you know, all that goes against also having good in-ring ability between both combatants. So if you're going to have two people that aren't super, super skilled, you could better tell a good story. And they didn't either tonight.
Yep. All right. Chris, back to you for anything else.
Yeah, just one last point. They've started teasing who is going to be the fifth person for the BCC and for the Elite. I'm pretty sure the fifth person for the BCC is going to be somebody from Japan if they can swing it. I believe there's a gap. I think it was Eric Kroll was saying there's a gap that might fit in with that event. Is there any world where the Elite's fifth isn't Kota Ibushi? Like, is there any chance it isn't him at this point? I kind of expected him to come running out tonight, but what other contenders even exist?
Tyler, what do you?
Yeah, I'm always notoriously bad at this, but that is, you know, a good take. Ibushi feels like it makes the most sense, but it feels like Ibushi's been not available, but like that secret card to pull for, you know, a minute now, for half a year or so, however long he's been out of contract with New Japan. So that makes sense. Anything besides that, obviously with Kingston, you know, he could, you know, they're selling him being gone in Japan. He could always come back as like a backup plan. I don't know what his actual schedule is. But, you know, even Jericho after tonight, I feel like could be some sort of odd person in there because he's got beef with Callis as well when he inevitably doesn't join his family. So I think all of those are possibilities. Ibushi's the most exciting, and Jericho feels the most Jericho way to do it, for him to, you know, put himself in a multi-man match that's super over and get, you know, help his babyface transition happen. So he would be my backup choice. And then with the BCC, yeah, someone from Japan or someone that fits Moxley's past, someone that might be on the indies now. I don't know who it would be, but someone that fits the same sort of mold of Eddie Kingston. And, you know, Moxley could use that as like, this is what Eddie Kingston could be in Victory or something like that. But I don't have any specifics at the moment for that character.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't have any other ideas than what Tyler just did and what you had, Chris. So yeah, we'll see. I don't know. Nothing obvious jumps out, but I do think they've got something in mind. You know, I mean, I think they have this figured out. It's just a matter of revealing it as we go.
I just had the terrifying thought, based on what you said, Tyler, that Nick Gage is going to be the BCC fifth. And I don't think
I
want
to
see that.
I didn't
want
to put it out there, but yeah. I mean, he would be
I think there's a solid chance that Dark Order ends up joining BCC, joining Callis's family, and it could be one of those guys. But there's no real obvious singles guy in that group. There's only three of them now anyway. It's a tricky one, but Ibushi, as much as I would like to see him on TV regularly, I actually think he would be a bad choice because it just plays more into what Tony Khan does. Here is a guy that had one run in the Cruiserweight Classic, decided he actually didn't want to be in America, flew back to Japan. Very few people know who he is outside of the core 900,000 people that watch AEW every week. Some of them watching on delay for Collision, but you get 900,000. They don't know who he is. So bringing him in does not bring extra eyes to the product. This big reveal is really pointless. It does nothing for you because the people who are going to be excited about it were already watching. So I don't know. I want to see it, but I'm not the guy he should be going after. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think you have a good framing of why it's going to be a big deal to people who are already watching and interested in what they're doing, but it's not, you know, a big difference maker. And you know, doing that now and then is fine, but you need to have your eye on the big picture too. And by the way, I thought this episode of Dynamite was one of the better ones in terms of vignettes and building up the matches on this show and catching people up on Collision and building up next week's Collision. Like 45 minutes into the show, I'm like, are they going to plug Collision? And then they really did at the end of the first hour. This was a step in the right direction for me in terms of the balance between just pointing the camera at the ring and a bunch of high spots going on and Tony Khan flipping out backstage going, yeah, exciting, versus, hey, we're in a business. We need to bring new fans in. We need to make these moves count and be in context, and we need ramifications for wins and losses and know what people's different motivations and what's driving them is going into the match and what happens if they win and lose. All that was covered more in this show than way more than average for AEW. So it's not, you know, I think they're cognizant to that, that's an area that needs some refinement. But that doesn't change that they still might think, well, after all the response we got at Forbidden Door, there's nothing bigger we could do for selling tickets or at TD Garden than Kota Ibushi. And, you know, I don't know if people have time to book travel to be there, but Forbidden Door was built on a lot of people traveling in order to see people in person that they love on New Japan World and that kind of thing. So
yep.
You bring up
I was one of them.
Chris, anything else you want to bring up? Yeah.
Just real quickly, I think one of the things that really stood out for me tonight on that front was the Nick Wayne vignette. I thought that was probably one of the best things they've done to introduce someone new. I know the guy's 18 and he's going to lose to Swerve next week, but perfect opponent for him. They have history. They train together. I'm really excited about that. And I've completely forgotten the other point, so I will just leave it there. Thanks for taking the call, gentlemen. You have a good night.
Thanks, Chris. Email if it's important, if you think of it. Take care.
I will.
Great. All right. Next we'll go to Jay in Hartford. Jay, welcome. What's in your mind about Dynamite tonight?
Hey, good evening, Wade. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, sure can.
All right, good. Thanks, Jay. Thank you. Good evening to you and the co-host. Hey, so for starters, I'll start with the Owen tournament. My question for you guys about it is it just me or does it not feel, I'm not even sure of the word, so forgive me, mainstream isn't the word that I want. It just doesn't feel, it feels sort of less than background. So the only thing I could think of while I was waiting on hold to describe what it feels like to me. So you know when the WWE first started doing like overseas pay-per-views, and they were like outside of the normal 12, like Beast in the East, or you know, they had a few of them, right? Or maybe when they first started doing like Crown Jewel, it'd be like an event that didn't really tie into current storylines, but it's like, oh, this event we're going to have, we're going to make a big deal out of it, but you don't really have to care about it. That's what the Owens tournament feels like. And it's no disrespect to Owen Hart, whom I love. And I mean, the idea that they have the tournament, I guess, is cool. But is it just me, or does it sort of feel forced or out of place? I don't really know how to explain it, but it just seems to just be like, oh, look at us. We're AEW. We care about Owen's legacy. We're going to do this tournament. And I hope that doesn't come across as disrespectful, but it just doesn't really seem to add to the show is what I'm getting at. So I'll let you guys weigh in on it.
Yeah, no, I really agree. I mean, I don't think the tournament means a lot. I don't, you know, there's not an obvious, aren't obvious stakes. I think doing it as maybe a one-off would have been better than an annual thing. I think AEW just having matches that are just tournament matches isn't all that better than just having battle royals. I'd like to see, you know, the matches not just be the result of tournament matches and random draws for tag teams, that kind of thing, at least not in the quantity that they do them. And yeah, I mean, I mean, it's great that, you know, Owen Hart's widow endorses AEW carrying on his legacy, and it's cool that they're doing it in Canada. I think there's some good things going on with this, but I don't, yeah, I mean, I can't push back hard on what you're saying, Jay, that it doesn't feel like it's adding a ton. I mean, it's a tournament that doesn't mean a lot other than people carry the belts if they went around for a couple of weeks, and then they won't talk about it for 11 months or 10 months. So, yeah,
exactly.
What do you think, Josh?
Yeah, I agree. And I think this is a symptom of having, you know, 10,000 belts within the company, or if you're from another company and you have a belt, you have it. Or the video game where you can have five belts. everything feels lesser than, and this is kind of a symptom of that. And also, I think the tournament would have been good for the tournament if you did this blind tag tournament and then you turned that into the Owen tournament. Like, you know, I think Owen had lots of tag team partners and worked with different people in the past. You could spin it in that way, and then you keep the tournament alive, but it could fit your needs for booking year in and year out. It doesn't have to be a stagnant, hey, there's a men and a women's tournament, and here we go. Also, you know, Britt pulling out that belt tonight reminded me of how that's one of the worst modern belts in wrestling.
Yes.
And that doesn't help either. It makes it feel not prestigious at all to have a kind of a cosplay belt that kind of looks like a and it's not to be mean on purpose, but there's some, you know, indie promotions that make, like, belts that are the size of a, you know, a t-shirt, you know, from like the faceplate is literally 30 inches tall as like a funny thing. And that's kind of what these look like. So I don't think that helps either.
Oh man. Thank
Jay,
you,
what
Tyler. I wanted to say that belt was humongous. And I'm like, what is that?
I'm here for you.
The biggest belt I've ever seen. Yep. I guess this is only the second year they're doing it, but does this mean, well, I don't know. She lost tonight. So, I would think if you win the tournament, you just kind of keep that belt as your own personal trophy, or does that belt like get transferred since Britt showed it on air?
My hunch is it's a personal trophy and they come up with a new one each year, but I don't think it's been made clear. Tyler, did you have an assumption?
No, I mean, it's either, you know, a UFC belt every time even if you're a world champion, when you win another, if you defend your title, you have then a second or third belt, depending on how many times you defended it. I would like it more to be like the Stanley Cup, where there's one and everyone just gets to hold it, but there's also a cup. So I would say I would lean towards it's a personal belt year in and year out, but I do not think we'll get a definitive answer from AEW, if I had to guess.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks, Wade. One more thing on the tournament is I was even surprised to see that they had CM Punk in it. I felt like Punk in the Owen tournament, like, to me, he should be presented as way bigger than that. But, you know, maybe they did that to sort of add some, you know, prestige to the tournament itself. So I don't know. It just, you know, if they don't do it again, I won't feel. I'll be like, okay, cool, thanks, move on. But I'll go to another topic. The commentators. the commentary. I would love your opinion on this, Wade, and you, Tyler. I didn't get to call in a couple of weeks ago, but I'm looking at some notes where I was going to try to call in. I was very upset about Excalibur and the team, like, talking over MJF's entrance, right? He's your world champion. And I think his theme song is really cool, personally. But one thing I noticed on WWE, and I noticed it with Finn Balor's entrance last weekend, of course they're overproduced sometimes, but at the same time, there are certain parts of, like, theme songs that either the crowd sings along to or the wrestler, like, does a certain, you know, gesture or whatever, and commentary will lay out for that. AEW is, like, the exact opposite. They, like, talk all the way through, like, everything. They'll even talk over, like, the ring announcements if you let them. Like, I don't know if someone in their ear has to say, like, shut up, take a break. But it's a bit much. And what I noticed tonight was, like, there's something about Excalibur that I want to like him. He's a lot better to me than I thought he was, say, 2 years ago. I've gotten used to him. But he, of all of, like, everyone, I feel like I sound like Excalibur right now because I'm rambling, but he just doesn't know when to stop, right? So when the Hook and Jungle Boy backstage brawl happened, like, it was hardly even over before the graphic was on the screen, which isn't his fault, but the graphic was on the screen, and he was like, oh, yeah, what a segment. All right, this match is coming up. And it was just like, ready to move on to the next thing. Like, they don't let anything kind of, like, settle in and soak in. They're just like, all right, well, we got these six matches next week. We got this match in the main event. And regardless of how important a segment is supposed to seem, their commentators will not let you just kind of sit and breathe and enjoy the moment. They're just ready to ramble on to the next thing. And it's probably one of the most annoying things about the show, as much as I try to. I've seen every Dynamite, and I'm planning to stick around. I don't plan to go anywhere. I'm a wrestling fan, but some weeks it's hard. It's hard some weeks with the way they, like, Excalibur. They just don't stop. Oh, I don't know. I'll stop.
No, I've had that same feeling. You know, you do something and you want it to have impact, and I don't know that Hook Jungle Boy is the best example. It's an example, but I'm not saying it doesn't apply. But there's some really good examples that don't come to mind, but I remember my emotions watching them, which is that just happened and you pivoted after some platitude of, well, that didn't look good, but coming up next, it's like, wait, you got to let that stuff breathe a little. You've got to, you know, I truly believe the lead wrestling announcer has to have as, like, their guiding principle, what I'm calling is real. And that's your job as a narrator, to narrate the show as if it's real and not go, well, that was an angle, but this is a TV show and we need to keep moving on. No, if that really happened, what would your reaction be? And I know in wrestling, a lot of crazy stuff happens compared to, let's just say, the real world, but the real world's full of a lot of crazy stuff these days too, much more serious. But, you know, it's more than typical sports. So, but, you know, you can't undercut it by just, you know, the shoulder shrug pivot after no time or 5 seconds. And they do that too much. No question about it. And, you know, talking over ring entrances, I mean, they're trying to get their stuff in and they worry fans will be bored if there isn't chatter going on and that kind of thing. That didn't jump out to me tonight, but things like that have. And it doesn't mean if I watched it back, I wouldn't go, oh yeah, that was bad. Jay was right. But yeah, I mean, I've had an issue with the sort of human emotional connection that Excalibur has. And Excalibur comes across a little bit like an AI wrestling announcer with a lot of knowledge fed into it, but not a lot of humanity being expressed in reaction to what's going on. And there's not a lot of range to his emotional reactions to things. And when he does tap into emotions, it feels like the AI program, I'm not using language right, tells him this is when you should show emotion, and then he kind of struggles to do it. That's what I think what keeps him from being a great announcer, because there's a lot else he has going for him. But, yeah, I mean, and some of that is just being produced and coached, and I think by now he would be coached and produced differently if that stuff was on Tony Khan's radar too. Tyler, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, on the big view of it, I mean, there's definitely a spectrum of producing announcers, right? And AEW's way on one side and WWE's way on the other side. And I think most of us would agree a happy in the middle of both of those would be probably the most ideal, where you get some leeway as an announcer to have your own personality and do things like that. But also, you know, if you're Tony Khan on the headset, you need to tell, you know, people to shut up occasionally and they need to listen to you, sort of thing. And, you know, that's just not Tony's vibe. And also, you know, just everything being bang, 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 bang. And next thing, next thing, next thing is just the Tony Khan style, especially with Dynamite. That's more to identity. I mean, Collision feels like that a lesser extent. It feels different in its own way. But, you know, I think AEW would supremely be helped by big things, you know, happening and cutting to black without an announcer saying anything. And, you know, not that you need to do that all the time, but that would really lay in thick that this is a pretty monumental moment and it needs to breathe. And I just don't know if that's Tony Khan's style. And, you know, Excalibur seems more like a instrument of Tony Khan's style than that's his chosen way to do it if you gave him the option. But now he's kind of set in his ways as the AEW voice on Wednesday. So, yeah, I think it's certainly, you know, not the biggest issue within the company by any stretch. It is something to take note, and I have enjoyed the commentator presentation on Saturdays more than Wednesdays the last couple of weeks. Obviously, the Collision's only been on 3 weeks, so to be determined on that front.
Yeah. If Excalibur is the vessel of Tony Khan, he's missing Tony Khan's enthusiasm and emotions. You know, because Tony is so emotive, and Excalibur is in this super narrow lane of just calling it as he sees it. And so, but I know what you're saying when you say that, Tyler. Like, there are, you know, what he focuses on are the things that are important to Tony, but he's missing that you know, human emotional connection, and that sort of natural reaction that I think Tony has on headset, you know, when he's watching stuff. And Excalibur is very, you know, Excalibur might be a very good golf announcer or tennis announcer, but it's pro wrestling. And it's, you know, so anyway, Jay, back to you.
Thank you. Appreciate you guys' take on it. Speaking of announcers, one thing I did notice tonight was Renee Young. And I didn't just notice it tonight, but she's just awesome. She's awesome in her backstage role. So as I was watching the show, I'm like, I'm going to stand there when I call in, because she can do no wrong to my eyes in that backstage, you know, interviewer. She just does it so well. She makes me pay attention. She asks the right questions. And I know she didn't work out on commentary as well, but I just feel like, you know, others can maybe learn from her. But one more thing, and I'll move you or let you get to other callers. Holly Cameron, and maybe I haven't paid attention because I watch a lot of shows fast-forwarded, or via DVR, and I'm like fast-forwarding through. Like even tonight I sped through so I could call, but I made sure to pay attention to everything. But who is Holly Cameron? Like, I don't know. Like, is she from Rampage? Is she from Collision? Like, she popped up on the screen, and this is, I'm going to assume you know who I'm talking about, but she popped up during the Acclaim post-match saying she's a musician, and I just didn't know who it was. So, like, am I not paying attention, or have they not told us who she is and she just popped up tonight for the first time?
They play to the 400,000 people who watch everything that AEW does, and they have not done much to introduce her outside of Rampage, Tyler.
Yeah, I mean, literally tonight I was typing my report and she popped up on the screen, and she said her name near the end, but I audibly yelled at on my couch like, why do I not know your name as like a viewer of AEW, because she's been on for a while. She's been in those vignettes, those QTV things, the TMZ knockoffs, and was there.
Okay.
And she's done stuff outside of Rampage, but literally I forgot her name because I don't watch Rampage every week, I'm being honest with everybody. But it is insane. And she did say her name, but the presentation of you're getting TV time on still the most premium AEW product from a live viewership standpoint, and you're not assuming that everyone doesn't know this person's name is, I was very upset, but then she said her name. So I guess I can take it back a notch, but you know, I never audibly yelled by myself in my living room at the TV, but I did hear, because I was just like such a microcosm of issues I have week in and week out. So, but they did rectify it. So that was good.
You're just peanut butter and
jelly. I mean,
yeah, there you go.
Oh, I guess that was clever. I mean, I won't bring up a new topic. I was pretty much done. But when you mentioned Tyler not watching everything, hang me up after this. But I watched Rampage for a few weeks. I no longer watch. Mm-hmm. And as someone who really enjoys, I never miss the Raw or SmackDown. I try to watch everything or as much as I can. You know, when you are a father and a husband and you got a family life and there's so much media to choose from nowadays and you're binge watching, like there's just not enough time, right? So Rampage mm-hmm. was not able to keep me around. I only watch Dynamite consistently. I'm trying with Collision right now. I've watched the first two or three, however many it's been, via DVR. But after this past Saturday's Collision, I was like, I'm going to keep trying. I'm going to keep it on my DVR schedule, but I don't know that they've really pulled me in. So what I'm leaving you with is, how well do we think Collision is doing? If that's okay to ask on a Wednesday night show, post-Dynamite show. I think they'd be fine with just Dynamite and one other show, be it Rampage or Collision, but I just don't see myself like being a hardcore viewer of Collision as I am Dynamite. So that's all I got.
Thanks, Jay. Yeah. We put up the ratings today at pwtorch.com. I did an editorial because I think there's reason for concern, but not alarm. It was a holiday weekend. It was a pre-taped show. They didn't advertise Punk ahead of time. So had they drawn the number they drew this week and it was not, and they had a loaded show and did a good job promoting it, and it wasn't a holiday week, that'd be terrible. That said, this is not good. You know, I mean, my pitch is they need to be on guard that they need to make some changes. I mean, they've lost, almost half their viewership. After 2 weeks, they were, 816,000 first week, 452,000 this week, 408 would be half. They're less than 50,000 above being at half the point that they started at. And they started at a Dynamite level number, not something way off the charts good for a 2-hour live primetime show from United Center. And the in-between show was 595,000. So they dropped under 600,000. That was on the lower end, I think, of what people thought was possible. It wasn't like impossible, but it was certainly on the lower end. And then this week they lost, another 140,000, give or take. So it's not good. I wrote a Keller's take at pwtorch.com. Hope everybody can go to the website on your phone or your laptop and check that out. I made a few suggestions for what they can do just as a little course correcting. I think some of it was already planned because I think Dynamite did a pretty good job with just really not just saying what's happening on Collision, but hearing from the wrestlers who are going to be on Collision and talking about what's at stake in the matches that they're advertising for Collision. So I thought they took some steps in the right direction. I absolutely expect a rebound. If they end up above 600,000, I think everyone will, breathe a sigh of relief. And if they end up in the mid or low 500s on a non-holiday week while advertising as well as they did on Dynamite, a pretty strong lineup, I think there'll be reason for concern. Tyler, your take on what Jay brings up, the state of Collision, especially viewership, and do you agree tonight was a step in the right direction in terms of rather seamlessly and in a way that was still entertaining, because we got to hear from Joe and Punk, for example, mm-hmm. Building up a very big Collision. And do you agree that, anything above 600 would be a sigh of relief, but it won't be celebrated unless they, maybe get closer to 700?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, a lot of that's hard to say, it's more, that rating stuff is more what is Warner Discovery looking to get out of this extra show that they've added?
I included that in my ratings report, by the way. I put in what the movies were doing in that time slot on that station. Mm-hmm. And demographically and audience level, this week's was a little below a couple movies that they did. it's a very pertinent point, and my rating source, I had them dig that stuff up and I put it in the report. You wonder what is the threshold. You're going to the expense of creating a whole new live 2-hour wrestling show. Are you more trouble than you're worth if you can't beat that both audience wise and demographic wise?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's, the important take there. And, it seems like over 600, just as like and I'm not saying it's an arbitrary number you pulled up because obviously you're taking the last 3 weeks of data, but it still feels like, arbitrary point if I'm Tony Khan. You know, I want this thing to be at least at Dynamite's level, I think, week in and week out. And, you know, the plus 7 day numbers, I mean, you've talked about it a lot, but, you know, if you're watching on DVR, you fast forward through all those advertisers. So they want you to watch live. So that's the key number is that live number, not so much the tape number. And, you know, I just think like tonight's episode, I thought I did a good job selling Joe and Punk. You know, if you didn't watch last weekend, you might not know that was coming up on this week. So that's super important to do. The main event should do good numbers. I don't know if everyone will watch live those 2 hours. My guess is the majority of people, it'll have a good number for the main event, and then they'll watch live or watch on DVR later, which is kind of a mixed bag. So that's the kind of the micro view there. But just in general tonight, you know, I felt this way since the expansion post Forbidden Door, and it feels like any episode of major AEW content, whether that be a Dynamite or a Collision, you seem to be getting about 25% of anyone that you would consider to be a major star. You know, whether that you deem that to be 8 people, 6 people, whatever, you're going to get, it just feels not entirely watered down, but it feels, you know, not certainly the same as some high profile Dynamites where you're trying to get a good number and you have, you know, all 4 of your top stars at the time on the show. You know, you're stretching out who's there, who's not there, and you can feel like, hey, John Moxley's not here this week, and we got a pre-tape. And just things like that are happening where it just feels like a watered-down product all the way across the board, as opposed to, hey, let's build 6 stars on Dynamite and 6 stars on Collision. Now, you've talked about this ad nauseum, Wade, but it just feels like that's why
Raw.
Ad nauseum
makes it sound bad. You could use a different word.
You know, I still want to be
thoroughly, consistently. No, go ahead.
Like, I stole your food analogy. Yeah. I don't want to be Wade Jr. over here and steal all your takes.
Ad nauseum has a negative bend to it. Like, shut up, Wade. We heard enough of it. And if you meant it, stand by it, but I just make sure.
Yeah. Maybe that's just my personal take there. Sorry for getting that in there. No, I'm just kidding. But you know, that's why, you know, it's not rocket science. So that's why Raw and SmackDown work, right? Because there are set stars you see week in and week out, and the show is built around them every week, and you build stories around those main characters. And not that Dynamite and Collision need to be clones of that, but I need to know, like, I'm going to see Kenny wrestle every week. You know, I need to see Jay White wrestle every Saturday, and I need to then be involved in that guy. I need, and I know I've said this a lot, I've said this ad nauseum, so I'll put that on myself as well. But I need my big stars to get the Orange Cassidy treatment on both these shows so that I feel a connection to those characters week in, week out. I know what I'm going to get, and not just be like, oh, I guess Wheeler Yuta and Kenny Omega is going to be the biggest match on this card, so maybe I will or won't watch this because the card looks pretty weak. No, I need to know, like, I'm going to see Kenny, I'm going to see Moxley, I'm going to see the Bucks, Cole, and MJF on every Dynamite. I'm going to see Punk and Jay White and Samoa Joe and Miro every Saturday and build it around those guys. And it's not happening. And I think it would help tremendously to get a consistent rating with all that stuff. So
do you think they should be, because that was one of the points of my editorial today. They should be explicit about it. They should say, these are, you know, the 4, 5, 6 people that you could only see on Collision and only stand up. But then they sort of have to explain why, and they don't want to. So there's sort of wanting people to kind of pick up on the fact that if you want to see Miro, Andrade, not John Spears, Sky, oh my God.
Oh, Scorpio Sky.
Scorpio Sky, thank you, yes. Mm-hmm. I double S's and John Spears is the only one coming to mind. And of course, CM Punk, and FTR for that matter. Why? Like, they could have come up with something. They could have had a draft, and they're like, if you're, you know, an exclusive top-tier talent, you're going to have an exclusive home. And I don't know. It's like they want people to pick up on it, but they don't want to own it. But that's actually a thing. And I think if you own it, even if it doesn't make sense and you don't have a good reason why, that some people like the Acclaimed are on both shows, but there's these top 6 people who are only on one show, even if you can't explain it, at least your viewers know it, and you're – I don't know. I guess, you know, letting them know if you want to see CM Punk, you got to tune in Saturdays, except for a little recap and vignette like we got on Dynamite tonight.
Yeah.
By the way, go follow up on that.
I was just going to say, like, on that, like, you could easily do, you know, Tony Khan, his dad owns a football team. You could even do, like, the Collision division and the Dynamite division. You have your top 4 stars.
Yeah.
And they just, like, that's why, you know, the Minnesota Vikings play the Detroit Lions, the Bears, and the Green Bay Packers twice a year because they're in the same division. And that's why you – these guys are on that show more often. You can just spin it as a sports-like feel. I know it's not exactly the MO of the company at this time, but like things like that, like big stars, like you said, and here's the framing of it. And that feels like, okay, they're repping the brands. That's why Punk is making references. I'm not even supposed to be here, which is fine, but just like make, like, why do I know about that if I'm a normal viewer? So sorry, go ahead to your next point.
Yeah. Oh, no, I was going to go back to something you brought up about the delayed viewership. And I hear a lot of people talking about, you know, well, you know, if the numbers aren't high on Saturday night, people are going to watch it on DVR. And yes, advertisers prefer that you watch live, but it's amazing how many people don't fast forward. Like, they just sit through the stuff on DVR. I've seen stats on that. I haven't gotten updated stats on that, but I think people would be surprised how often people just, a commercial comes on and they just pick up their phone or they run to the kitchen or the bathroom or let the dog out, and it just plays in real time. So advertisers don't hate, you know, they don't just write it off entirely, but yes, they'd rather you watch live. But when you watch live, you can be doing all the things I said and miss the commercials too. However, the idea is, but in terms of people seeing CM Punk, the number, the however many hundreds of thousands are seeing him, the idea, you know, it's not just about, the networks care about the ratings. That's all they care about. But AEW cares about how many people are watching overall, not just 18-49, because a lot of people buy pay-per-views who are outside of that age range, and a lot of people buy tickets who are outside of that age range. So, and merch. So those grand total numbers are important, including the 3 and 7 day viewership numbers that we report exclusively on a semi-regular basis here. So I'll point out the second week that drew 595,000 viewers for Collision grew by almost 100,000 viewers to 692 after 3 days. So we just got that data. Dynamite on that same week, the June 21st edition, grew by 91,000 viewers after 3 days. So there's no difference. I mean, statistically speaking, it's in the margin of error. The both shows after 3 days grew the same amount. Going back to the original show, the original Collision on June 17th, it went after 7 days, because we have that data, 816,000 viewers first for live and same night went on a Saturday. By the 7 day mark, 952,000. So they grew, I'm doing fast math here, but 136,000. Dynamite that same week after 7 days grew 130,000. So we're not seeing that big Sunday, Monday, Tuesday catch up on the DVR viewership number for Collision so far. And, you know, it's one week for 7 day and only 2 weeks for 3 day. But so far, it doesn't look like there's going to be like this explosion of young males who go out on Saturday night, but then can't wait to watch Collision Sunday or Monday. That is not happening yet. So I'm just kind of throwing that out there as a bit of a, not a mythbuster, but just we're all talking about it. So it's just, we're busting not an assumption, but in maybe a way to mitigate how bad those live numbers are if they grow more on delays. So far, they haven't been. So throw that out there for us to incorporate into our framing of whether Collision is underperforming. Jay, appreciate the call. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah, you're welcome, Jay.
There he is.
All right, you can still call us if you want, 347-215-8558. Push 1 when you call. You can also email wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. All right, I was just about to go to Grant in Detroit, and there he is. Grant, welcome. What's on your mind about Dynamite tonight? And Derek, by the way, you're on deck, so don't hang up on us. Go ahead, Grant. Oh, he just hung up.
Okay, go ahead, Grant. Can you hear me? So my question is for you, Wade. So I was trying to go back and see what you and like some of your contemporaries thought about like the Lethal Lottery, since you know they just have you doing this Blind Eliminator tournament. And from what I see, none of y'all pretty much liked it at all. So I'm just trying to think So far, do you think they've done a better job with the concept, or do you like it at all, or how do you feel about it?
Well, that was like 3 decades ago, and we're in a kind of a different world. AEW is different than WCW in certain ways, for better, and in certain ways they're different, that's good, in certain ways they're the same and it's bad. I mean, it was silly and novel back then, and I think we largely kind of scoffed at it for some of the convenient stuff. But it just – I don't think as a concept to build a pay-per-view around, it was like – it sort of felt like someone sat in a room and said, this has never been done before, which to me is always the beginning of a really bad idea. The precursor to a really bad idea. There are a lot of WWE creative team members who I've interviewed, and they're like, yeah, we sat around. We said, we've never done this before. Yeah, that's because it's been thought of, and someone was smart enough to go, oh, that's a dumb idea. Let's not do it. I don't have strong animosity towards it. If it went away, I wouldn't miss it and encourage it to come back. I guess I'm sort of agnostic on it. Again, if they don't have too many convenient enemies teaming up or existing partners teaming up, that just goes completely against the odds. You know, it just seems too convenient. I just think you want to minimize that. Like, the Cole MJF skit was fine, but I didn't need three camera angles for the bench press when it was clear there weren't cameras there filming the other angles and was all shot in separate takes, and then they spliced it all together. I don't need that for an on-location shoot. Just give me a handheld. You know, it doesn't have to be all sitcom, multi, you know, three camera shoot. It makes it seem fake to me in a way that doesn't add, the negative is bigger than the positive. I know most people don't think of that, but I think it cuts into the idea that, yeah, this is just, they've dragged the camera guy with them and they're filming doing this. We just, you know, NXT has been awful about that. And I've been critical of NXT when they do that too. So to me, like, you want to suspend your disbelief, you know, giving wrestling extra latitude to be kind of fakey. You want to spend those when it really is needed. So that's my, you know, concern about the tournament is, How contrived is it? You just make sure your contrivances are necessary and have a big payoff, or edit them. But like I said, I'm largely agnostic. I think there's some fun aspects to seeing mix and match tag teams. It can feel like a bit of a substitution for just booking 101. You know, I don't know if crutch is the right word, but yeah, just kind of a substitution of, oh, I can exhale now because I can just do this kind of fun, goofy, random matchups. But so far, I mean, I think they're telling stories with it and using it as a tool to advance some storylines. So, I mean, I'm probably, even with everything that I've said, giving it more of a thumbs up than a thumbs down so far. Tyler, how about you?
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. Like I said, maybe the top show or the first caller, but I just feel like the AEW's portraying it as prestigious as it needs to be. It's really, you know, the prize at the end is a title shot, and everything else in between feels, you know, hey, it's a tournament, but it's not like, you know, it's not the most prestigious thing in the world to win this. So AEW feels like it's a wink and a nod for me as a viewer who knows what's going on, that this is a booking mechanism and it's being treated as such in the right way. But yeah, I mean, if they were telling bad stories, if it was truly just random people, if it was Matt Sydal and Lee Moriarty as a tag team, and they were taking on Big Bill and Jericho, that would be not good. So they're doing the best of both with this, and it's a totally fine tournament. But, you know, again, I'd like less tournaments. I'd like not two tournaments going on at the same time. I'd like less battle royals, et cetera. So in the grand scheme of AEW, it's more in line of what they do and kind of overusing gimmicks. But yeah, I think this one in particular is working pretty well for me as well.
Yeah. All right. Grant, back to you. Any follow-up on that or a different topic?
Different topic. I just was curious about that. So my next question is, and it may be beating a dead horse, but what do you think they are doing with Swerve? Because once again, he took a 10 today, and then now he's going to face Nick Wayne next week. And if he loses to him, like, where does that leave him? When I feel like he could probably be one of your probably top heels in the company, like.
Yeah, I mean, it comes across as if, based on his history, like, that bookers and promoters recognize there's talent, but don't want to really get behind him. And, you know, you wonder if there's a reason, justified or not, for that. Because it just seems like there's enough there, charisma-wise, ring skill-wise, look-wise, everything. You'd want to, like, build around him as one of your top, you know, top four or five heels or babyfaces, whatever role he's in. And he just always seems short of that. But do you agree? He checks the boxes otherwise. And so I should ask around about that. I mean, I don't know why he isn't more protected and he doesn't just get a more clear-cut top-tier push, because all those boxes are checked where you would do it. and promoters time after time don't. Tyler.
Yeah, I mean, I'm, you know, if anyone reads my reports or hears me talk, I'm kind of, I have a lot of stock in Swerve. I'm a big fan, and I would agree. I think he's underutilized as well. I think he's got the potential to be a top four, top three guy if you use him correctly. And I'm curious, you know, if you ask him and what you can drum up there, because, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if it's the other way of, like, Swerve, he might be, this is just me speculating, but he might be so confident that he can make anything work that he's like, oh, yeah, give me this random Ring of Honor Trios tag team champions that you don't ever see except when they come out with me, and I'll make it work because I'm so good at what I do. And that might be a hindrance to him where, you know, he'll just do, he might be too much of a company guy, you know, or it's the opposite. You know, I'm curious if you get any info on that, but it's just like, he seems to take whatever like is given to him and will make the best of it. And that is, you know, kind of the old school way. He's a good hand. He's a guy who can, you know, would he be the Intercontinental Champion in 1989 in WWF? And never be world champion. It feels like he's the modern version of that to me. And I don't really know why that's the case, because he can make, you know, lemonade on a regular basis, I think.
Mm-hmm. Grant, back to you.
That's all I have for y'all tonight. We'll catch y'all probably Friday.
Sounds good. Thanks, Grant. Talk to you then. We had Derek on hold, but he... Once I took Grant, he had to bail. Understand, it's can be late. Although in Utah, it's not that late. Let's go to some emails here, and we'll begin with JB in Jacksonville. He goes, "Hey Wade and Tyler, hope you both had a great fourth. Just a quick message to say, I'm a huge AEW fan. I've ordered every pay-per-view and have been to tons of shows living in Jacksonville. With that said, it's just becoming too much. I haven't felt like I've even caught my breath yet from Collision and Forbidden Door, and it feels like a million tournaments are going on. A big Collision's coming up in a couple days, and then Excalibur out of the blue. Speed reads a big card for Rampage 100 in the middle of making a bunch of other points. On top of that, there are three massive shows in All In, All Out, and Grand Slam on the horizon. By the way, I have a good article up on pwtorch.com talking about the challenge of having multiple shows a week apart, basically. Dan Ellenson, our All Elite assessment specialist, who writes weekly columns on AEW at PW Torch, addressed that point about kind of with an eye on history about how do you run shows close to each other, and is there a way to differentiate them successfully? So check that out, everybody, if you haven't yet. PWTorch.com in the opinion and analysis section. So back to the email. He says, on top of that, there are three massive shows on the horizon. It's a weird thing to complain about, I know, and I don't know what the solution is, but I feel like I have no choice but to eventually just start skipping stuff soon. I sent over an email a few days ago mentioning anecdotal social media activity led me to believe Collision would be in the 400s this past week, and that same activity is screaming 700s tonight, as they were weighed down from last Wednesday. Interesting. Last time they were in the 700s was, let's see here, May 3rd show. And that's the one time they were in the 700s so far this year, through over a half year. And then before that, it was back in October. So yeah, we'll see. Your statistics, we'll see if they hold up this week, but that's interesting. So he goes, just curious as if you think this is too much content, if this content is too much or sustainable long-term, especially with WWE hotter than it's been in years. So that's JB in Jacksonville. What do you think, Tyler? I mean, too much or too early to say too much, because we should let Collision find its lane and Rampage, as long as it's an optional show and the networks are happy with a late Friday viewership of 400-some thousand, you know, whatever. It's sort of with Dark and Dark Elevation gone. There's no harm. I mean, I think there's a way to spin it. And WWE has 5 hours a week with Raw and SmackDown. AEW's got four and now five, I guess, if you count Rampage. It's not that different. What's your take?
Yeah, I mean, I as a viewer think it's too much, but I think the problem for AEW, in my opinion, and I don't know if there's any stats that can back this up, it's just my, you know, gut instinct, is that, you know, if you take those, let's say 900,000, to be generous, hardcore viewers of AEW that watch a majority of the cable product, I would say a vast percentage of that audience is also watching WWE, or at least it may be Raw or maybe SmackDown, and then definitely the pay-per-views. And obviously that bigger chunk of audience watching WWE is not watching also AEW. because, you know, a hardcore wrestling fan is going to watch as much as possible, as that's kind of the MO of the hardcore wrestling fan. So obviously that's not, you know, rocket science, and that's built into the advantage, the moat that WWE has being the number one, you know, being synonymous with wrestling is WWE. So that doesn't help, but, you know, to make a choice there of, hey, you've got, you know, let's take out NXT and Rampage. So you've got 9 hours of wrestling content weekly on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and then Saturday. It's just hard to spin that and watch that live for anybody. So, you know, I'm not breaking any news here, but I think if I'm starting a wrestling company, and it's hard to say no to a lot of money, but 2 hours of really, you know, pointed and making it feel special week in and week out is the way to win here, and not diluting the product by stretching it over time. And, you know, coming up here, we just saw with Forbidden Door, where you have a show on Saturday and then a 5-hour pay-per-view on Sunday, and then you're supposed to watch 2 hours on Wednesday. None of them are really necessary to watch the other ones, but you feel like you need to watch it to be completed. And when we get into August with All In, then All Out, and then a couple weeks later with the Grand Slam thing, it's just tough. And it is going to, you're going to get diminishing returns. I just feel like that's where we are. And, you know, if Rampage was there, I don't think it would matter, but it's having those two-hour shows that feel as important as the, you know, Raw and SmackDown stuff. But it took SmackDown, I mean, what, 15 years and going live to feel as important as Raw?
Yeah.
Maybe I'm off even on that number. So it takes a long time to build up and make, like, Raw and SmackDown feel equal to me. And obviously being live on Friday on Fox makes SmackDown feel prestigious, and then Raw is the original, so it's always going to feel prestigious. But you know, you got to go through a lot of time to build that. And I, you know, will cable even being around 15 years for Collision to feel important?
No.
I don't know, but
yeah,
that, yeah, I would agree. So that's kind of where we are, in my opinion, on it.
Yeah, I mean, my short answer is, if I were Tony Khan, I would not have expanded to Rampage or Collision. I would have made Dynamite the best must see show. I would have trimmed the roster greatly and focused on the best talent, but a relatively small roster, a little bit more of an impact formula in that sense. And, you know, been more selective, have some dark matches before Dynamite and maybe some house shows where you try out other talent, but let the talent prove themselves elsewhere. And you know, have your core group that, you know, just, I mean, it's not comparable to, like, really other TV shows, but, you know, there are ensemble TV shows where people are, you know, fine tuning in to the same people, the same group of people every week, you know, doing stuff and telling their stories. So, yeah, I mean, it doesn't mean you want to overexpose just 18 wrestlers, but if you had a more trim roster, you would save on the budget, and then you would just have this mega successful Wednesday show, in theory, or it'd be more possible if you weren't spread so thin. But that doesn't mean they can't make Rampage and Collision work and financially have it pay off. But we have the history of WCW as the example. SmackDown is more of a success story than Thunder obviously was. And keeping Dynamite at 2 hours instead of 3, I think is more important than whatever. You know, I would choose add Rampage or add Collision before I'd expand Dynamite to 3 hours. And I'm glad Tony's resisted that, because I think you really start watering down a lot of things if you do that, including your live audiences, you know, who are watching a pay-per-view length TV show at the arenas and on TV every week. And so at least it's spread out. You know, there's a business side. We've got all these wrestlers side. Wouldn't it be fun if we had more, a whole other show and it was successful? But you can learn from history and see, you know, it can break two different ways. All right. Azan in St. Louis is up next. Why, hi, Wade and Taylor. Tyler, why is AEW doing a weird throwback character from Attitude Era with Haley Cameron? A side note, she is a real singer who did the Inspiration entrance music on Impact. I don't know. I mean, it's a really weird thing to give TV time to. I don't know that. I think I'd be doing different things with the Acclaimed than this. Tyler?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to speculate, but, you know, QT is big, you know, he's in Tony Khan's inner circle, if you will, and he gets TV time. I think that most people would say is not super deserved on the input on screen, and seems to be a friend of his, I would guess. So,
yeah.
You know, just like anyone that he maybe has trained or thinks should be on TV kind of gets there. And I think that's kind of what's happening here. So, yeah.
Yeah. On number two, could you see a case where Sammy and Danny Garcia win the whole tournament and beat FTR? Because that seems right up Tony Khan's wheelhouse.
it seems like it's up Tony Khan's wheelhouse, especially to overpush Sammy. And I don't think Tony Khan has had the track record for, like, you know, I think it's pretty sterling on knowing when and when to not push somebody. And so, you know, like, let's say the example of Christian Cage, he brought him in to be a big star, I think, with his mindset, and maybe promised him at least a title shot. And he got through that and then kind of put Christian in that lane of where he kind of was based on the audience reaction to him. And, you know, Sammy's the only guy that I can think of off the top of my head that maybe Wardlow for me personally, but where Tony Khan has seemed to overpush based on the response and making character changes that don't fit a couple of times. And so, yeah, Sammy winning with Daniel Garcia makes sense from a Tony Khan booking pattern perspective, but I think that would be one of the worst outcomes of this tournament if that were the case.
And number three, I appreciate the fact that AEW is showing when people on the roster win big championship matches elsewhere. I think it means it makes their stars feel like bigger deals. How do you feel about that, Eddie Kingston's win? They obviously, AEW has a fan base where knowledge of New Japan and is important, and it adds some international credibility to their roster that they're working with this, the biggest company in Japan, the biggest wrestling company outside of the United States. But it is another title that's in the ecosystem of AEW. We even had the weird thing of Jungle Boy saying he wants to go to Tony Khan and get an FTW title shot. And it's like, you don't go to Tony Khan for that. It's not an AEW title. It's just a belt Hook carries around. So, you know, how does that get through? Like, I mean, either it's sanctioned or it's not. And if it's not, you know, then Jungle Boy should be going, I'm going to Tony Khan to demand a match with Hook, and I hope Hook will put that belt on the line because I want to take the pride of his family away from him. That works. But how does that make air when you're going, Tony Khan's going to designate a title match? So, but that's a sidebar mini rant. So I mean, I have mixed feelings, you know. I don't have a big problem showing Eddie Kingston winning. I think it was the right thing to do. But I do think there's sort of a downside of, like, man, there's a lot of titles out there in the world. And like, when you're in AEW, like, it should be about, hey, there's, you know, a few titles and everybody's working towards them. And when you realize people can just travel all over the place and pick up titles here and there in Mexico and in Impact and in Japan, it is sort of the belts for everyone mentality. It's like, if your company is AEW and you want to, you know, you want the focus of the company to be, this is where the wrestlers come to win the most prestigious titles, they shouldn't leave to go win some other title, and that makes them happy. So there is that downside aspect to it. Tyler, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I'll start on the positive. I think, you know, obviously there's a good working relationship with New Japan at this time in AEW. So I like that if your AEW performers are going over there, you're mentioning it. And, you know, if they win titles and seem important, and does that build the profile of Eddie Kingston by sharing this? Yes, all that works for me. And him winning a belt over there makes sense. And you're putting over your partners in New Japan and all that sort of stuff. So that all works for me. But yeah, it's you know, I'm a pretty staunch, like, have a world title, a secondary title, a tag title, and anything other than that has to really, you have to really convince me why it is good for the company and good for the other characters to be doing that. Cause you can have these tournaments and, you know, you can win a tournament and it's not for a title, et cetera. So that all hurts. And especially in this case, I mean, the New Japan Strong, which is the U.S. affiliated version of New Japan, it's not actually New Japan. And then the Openweight title is essentially their All-Atlantic title or their international title, what have you. So you're talking about the secondary brand, least important belt is what Eddie Kingston won here. So that doesn't help this argument whatsoever, that in the grand scheme of AEW New Japan partnership, this might be the least prestigious belt that Eddie Kingston won. And, you know, you're giving some shine to it, but it's, you know, if he's walking around with that thing, it just is not helpful when everyone in a match has a belt. You know, it's just not helping anyone look important, as I've stated many times, and you have stated also a belt for everybody. Then none of the belts
ad nauseum
are worth anything.
I won't say who.
Yeah. And, you know, and it doesn't help on the same show. Again, I'm not super critical right now. I wanted the story to play out with MJF, but, you know, You have your world champion who is actively for weeks on end not competing, not defending, or really talking about his world title besides having it on him while everyone else has a belt as well. So if you were to drop in, if you're an alien dropping in watching AEW, you would really have no idea what is the most important thing that these weird humans are fighting for.
Yeah, totally correct. All right, JB from Detroit is up next. He goes, what do you think of the Don Callis family debuting after the Blood and Guts match in Boston and beating down Kenny and the Elite? We haven't talked much about the Don Callis-Chris Jericho segment, Tyler, a big part of the show. Mm-hmm. Talk about that. Tell me where you think they're going with it and how you think they executed Chapter 1 here.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's surprising that we're like an hour and a half in the show and we've just now talking about Chris Jericho's babyface turn, presumably. I did not think it was a swerve. I think this is actually happening, and I think it's interesting for the character and not the way I thought it was going to go with him losing, you know, for months on end. I thought he would either double down and be the Painmaker version 2.0 or go babyface or take some time off and come back as a babyface. So not what I would have expected. And it seems strange to wait until he gets to Canada to do it when Jericho can get over in any town in North America, at least. And so, yeah, that's interesting. I'm curious to see where that goes. It was definitely time for a change in his character. And I'm curious to see what he does and how valuable he can be in this babyface role. But, yeah, I mean, the segment was strong. And obviously, Callis still is the most over heel in the company. And that's, you know, a good thing and to utilize that. But, you know, if his family debuts, anyone besides Takeshi that's in that group, you know, just like any faction, you have one person in the group that's the leader or the most important wrestler in that group. And it's hard for everyone else to get through. You know, BCC, the Elite, they work as factions because, you know, besides Yuta and BCC, everyone feels on a somewhat equal playing field. And I just think if you add, you know, we'll see who's in there, but whoever he adds, I think there's going to be Takeshita and then a 1B at most and then a couple of jobber guys in there. And that's just how it feels like this group's going to be, especially when your manager is the focal point of all the heat of the group. It's hard to have that be sustainable long term for those wrestlers. And, you know, you're going to kind of be the male version of the Outcast where they're just going to cheat seven times in a match, and that's going to kind of be their story as a group to get heat. And Callis is the one getting all the heat, just like we've seen with, you know, Dan Lambert trying to get over, I guess on paper, Ethan Page and Scorpio Sky and not working, and then other things like that. I just think a manager as the focal point getting the most heat is not a sustainable way to build wrestlers, in my opinion.
The MJF Cole pairing is obviously entertaining and the live crowds are eating it up, but is the angle worth it if it makes fans view the feud less seriously? I get the arguments for both sides. And when does the MJF Cole angle culminate and how should it? As always, love the show and go VIP. That's still JB from Detroit. I would talk to, you know, obviously a lot about this at the top of the show.
Mm-hmm.
The culmination will be in the finals of the tournament, probably, Tyler. That's what you're thinking. I think that makes sense. It could come sooner, but I doubt it will. And then it leads to an MJF Cole match with MJF as heel, Cole as a face at All In or All Out or both. Dan Allinson wrote about that in his column too at PW Torch. What, Tyler, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, you laughed and I said it jokingly and I hope it's not correct, but you know, Adam Cole did make a wish when he blew out his candle. So I really hope that's not the one wish that he brings up, like I said. So, you know, but you know, early on in this feud, obviously, it was if I have the machinations of this correct, right, it was a draw. So Cole does not have claim to another title shot unless MJF deems it to happen, is what I have.
But
right
he's
now.
Also not eliminated.
Yeah, because
he didn't lose.
So
yeah, yeah.
In the beginning of the story, you know, he goaded MJF into, you know, giving him a title shot and giving it, you know, earlier than expected. For MJF because he, you know, got him flustered. So I think if you bookend with that where Cole does not go heel and MJF loses as a result, takes the pin and is very upset about taking a pin on television, and then Cole, you know, goads him into having another title shot. That seems to be the kind of down the middle way to go for this to go. So, you know, maybe you alter that, you tweak that as it goes, but it seems to be, you know, Cole staying a babyface and getting MJF agitated enough to agree to another match. And maybe it's a, you know, I don't think it needs to get to this point, but, you know, a 60-minute, you know, Iron Man match, whatever.
Yeah.
I would hope it's just a regular singles match that doesn't have a time limit, maybe. And then he can go 25 minutes and call it a thing there. But, you know, and also we saw Cole have two matches in pretty quick succession with Adam Page. And I do not think those were super successful. So I would definitely avoid having two Cole MJF matches back to back in the all in, all out combination. But we'll see if that happens.
The point about is angle worth it if it makes fans view the feud less seriously? Are we too far down the road for it to have the type of intensity that a main event feud should have for both MJF and Adam Cole against anyone, including each other? Or is it fine if a match has a different tone? And can they pivot? Can they sneak in a little comedy but still have the match feel important and fierce when it finally happens and not have it feel sort of upper mid-card, haha, fun? You know, like Gable and Otis and Maxine doing something. Like, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, Jericho's done stuff like this before. You know, Kevin Owens and Sammy are playing it up just a little bit in that way. You know, like there's all kinds of like kind of comedic friends slash rivals of the past who get together again and then they break up and that kind of thing. Obviously, that's what this is inspired by. So, yeah, is it already too late? And even if it is, quote, too late, does it really matter? Because it's okay to have a world title match where the tone isn't, you know, bloodthirst.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's pretty close to teetering over that line of being kind of an unsalvageable is not the best word for it, because I don't think every, you know, world title feud needs to be like life or death within pro wrestling, but it needs to be still a competition, and we're to having it hard to bring it back to that competition for the most important prize, as opposed to making it a feud over, you know, you thought you were friends, but you're not. And that's why this whole sort of thing has felt like an MJF, you know, what he would do after his title run. It feels like what the story is more so than him while he's got the title, which is not necessarily a bad thing. It feels more like the next thing you do after you lose the title, a la Chris Jericho or something like that. But on that front, it's all about execution, right? If it's both guys are, you know, they both knew they were going to screw each other over from the start, and there's some sort of mutual respect from Cole and MJF that they both like equally screwed each other over the entire time, and then there's some like weird mutual respect and they have a match that is, you know, a 4-star match and is universally beloved, and then they go their separate ways, that can work in its own way. But if not, it's got to be, you know, one of them really screwing the other one over. And it would really at this point only make sense if it's Adam Cole who is playing MJF more so than MJF playing Adam Cole. But just determines who you want who to look, you know, more intelligent at the end. And AEW typically, it seems, tries to do more intelligent baby faces than the alternative when that question is brought up.
All right, then Zach in Texas is up next. Gentlemen, Dynamite was highly entertaining tonight. I actually enjoyed the way the Blind Eliminator tournament was handled. With the addition of the drawings revealing the teams, I definitely was transported back to being an 8-year-old kid watching Starrcade 91 on VHS. It definitely hit a nostalgia spot for me. The Adam Cole MJF stuff is working largely because Cole was nope perfect throughout the vignette in the match segment. He couldn't be more disinterested with MJF, as he should be. Cole is too smart to get conned by Max. As far as the Outcasts and Homegrowns go, I get the ridiculousness of the faces coming out alone. I just hope that when things come to a head, they address the fact that the reason the Outcasts have been getting the better of them is because they haven't been united. Just acknowledge it. Oh, and two thumbs up to the Nick Wayne vignette. Can't wait for his debut next week. You know, I mentioned in my Keller's take on Collision, one of the things that I think Collision needs is a breath of a dose of youth. Part of what I think was an early appeal of Dynamite was Darby Allin, Jungle Boy, MJF, and Sammy Guevara, the four pillars. And there was a freshness and a newness, and I'm at the beginning of something. And I'm super stoked for Punk versus Joe. I mean, I think that's great. Those are some of my favorite matches of the 2000s, and they put themselves on the map with that series, and I think they've done a nice job building it up. You know, but Miro's late 30s, Andrade is early 30s, going on mid 40s in certain ways. The way that he carries himself, and he's a man. He's like a man, not a boy. Is kind of my point. Like there's, and I think Collision feels kind of And part of this is through the atmosphere of the arena, you know, just having, you know, a couple thousand people in a darkened arena with echoey vibes. And then it's, a, you know, and Dustin, and I'm a fan of Dustin, I wanted him to use him more, but he adds to the problem with Collision last Saturday, which was that it felt old. It felt, you know, it felt like it was, and I don't mean old even derisively, because I think there's absolutely room for the whole range of ages, but there isn't that just sort of youthful energy and that spirit of a show being the future. It just doesn't have that. And so I say, you know, he mentioned Nick Wayne at the end of, if and I, maybe it won't work out storyline-wise because of Darby, but, you know, having Nick Wayne be a Collision regular or getting some of the younger guys over on Collision, I think would help balance things out too. I'm excited for the Nick Wayne thing. I thought the vignette was great. I think Darby's getting more comfortable on camera all the time. He's way more useful on the microphone than I think anyone 2 years ago would have predicted. He just really has kind of an alpha mentality instead of just, you know, sort of this mopey emo disgruntled with society type vibe, and it paints him as a good dude that he was there for Wayne after his dad died. So I like that too. Outcasts and Homegrowns, we talked about, you know, the ridiculousness of all the interference and all that and the match not being very good. I think Cole played it well, just going to Zach's comment. You know, I don't think he was off other than it. I think there's going to be some fans who look at what came across as making fun of a guy who's brave enough to go to the gym and knows there's people making fun of him. And Cole just participated in scumbag MJF's joke at his expense. And it was comedic because it reminds me of Tony Schiavone. And they said at the same time, I mean, the tone in that sense worked. It didn't feel vile because the joke was sort of at the expense of Tony Schiavone, but still, like, when you say he was tone perfect, was he? Because he's giving in to MJF's, and maybe that's part of the ebb and flow of the story they have to tell. And that's why I'm okay waiting and seeing. I didn't think this was awful, but in terms of saying he was no perfect, I guess for what he's asked to do, probably, you know, but I still have some issues with, can they tie this all together in the end and not do some damage or just have it feel rather arbitrary how Cole ultimately acts in the end. But my hunch is they're smart people involved on camera and off in this angle. And I'm hopeful and actually somewhat optimistic that some of this stuff is more nitpicky and won't really matter in the big picture. Tyler, over to you for anything from Zach's email.
Yeah, I would agree on that last point. And, you know, it's, you know, if, let's say, Cole's, you know, playing an undercover babyface going heel to kind of get in good with MJF and then screw him, or he's wearing a wire like an old, you know, gangster movie, that would make sense on the picture perfect thing or the tone perfect thing. But we have to wait and see what the end result is. But it's a big story. It's the world champion, and you know, you're setting up another match that is going to go the distance. It's a important thing. If company should be the most important storyline week in and week out, and should get, you know, overviewed by Tony Khan and the players involved, and get, you know, critiqued and storyboarded, etc. So we'll see if that happens. But the other thing, you know, we didn't talk about the Nick Wayne thing very much. I like that as well. And he's super talented. You know, he's been a the video they showed was from Defy Wrestling, which is up in the Pacific Northwest, but he's done a lot of GCW stuff, which is obviously a major indie promotion, and, you know, works that style well, and super athletic, and obviously will need time to mature into a, you know, wrestler on national television, but I think he's got a lot of upside. But this, you know, him getting this vignette and then losing to Swerve is the perfect way to go, and, you know, In 5 years, I think he could be a real player, but everyone thinks he's going to come in at 18. I don't think anyone's saying this, but, you know, what you're saying there, if you take Darby from, you know, the start of AEW to today, it's a vastly different character from the guy who handcuffed himself and went 10 minutes with Chris Jericho, and that was his most prevalent thing, to being a guy who feels like 10 years from now can be what Sting is for him. For somebody else, you know, that's a big jump in that character. So, you know, having that long-term trajectory with this, and it's a great point. It's kind of the underlying critique of AEW from that whole era where signing everyone from WWE and changing the identity of the company from, you know, young upstart rebel group where you're going to kind of get a fight for those people that are coming up and on the indies and giving them a platform as opposed to just being, you know, the rejects of WWE. Not having those Sammys, those Darbys, those Jungle Boys, those hot names on the indies coming up and becoming stars on television, is an important identity that was lost early on in AEW that would be good to rekindle some of that, not to make it exclusively the brand, but to have a couple of acts at a time doing that. So
we still got Sean Spears doing the Perfect 10, like on his whole journey is just back to the failed WWE mid-card gimmick. That's the best we really could do. Huh?
Yeah.
I mean, it probably is the right fit for him ultimately, but it's not something I want to see. Okay. In the opener, Orange Cassidy and Darby, speaking of Darby, beat Keith Lee and Swerve Strickland. What did you think of Keith Lee? I thought he had one of his better weeks in terms of taking his sort of natural disposition, demeanor, reaction things. He just kind of, there's a mellow, cool, take it as it come, kind of work at my own pace vibe to him in the ring and on the microphone. And in the end, you know, he's given fist bumps to the winning team. It didn't do a lot to make the Eliminator Tag Tournament feel prestigious that Keith Lee didn't mind losing. That is not a great thing. But in the end, I think he was like, I kind of lost my chance to win the tournament when I got the bad luck of the draw led to Strickland being my partner. So, you know, he probably emotionally was disconnected from the idea of winning anyway, because that would have meant taking Strickland along for a successful ride too, and he didn't want to do that. But what did you think of the story they told with that today?
Yeah, I mean, obviously that was the focal point of the story, is to kind of reestablish Keith Lee in the singles mid-card category, like someone that if, you know, Luchasaurus needs to take on someone for that TNT title, I feel like Keith Lee is now positioned in a spot to be more believable than he's been portrayed in recent weeks. And, you know, beyond that, I don't know, is there much more upside in the way Keith Lee's been portrayed or, you know, has kind of been there. So it is just interesting with a wrestler to see him like, okay, he's shaved and he dyed his hair back, and you just see like the effort level is on the screen visually for you versus 3 weeks ago where he's in a, you know, a battle royal. And, you know, that's not anything about against having gray hair. I think you can own that, and you don't have to have, you know, you can be Kevin Nash with gray hair, and I think you can be just as powerful as if you're dyeing your hair black. But you just see the effort in the ring versus that point too, and that could be lots of different things contributing to that. But yeah, I think it reestablished him, and that was the main goal of the early part of the match. And then, you know, I'm not as big a fan of, you know, Swerve and Keith Lee working together, you know, 100%. And then the only time there's disconnection is the accidental kick to the head. And now it's very contrived. And, you know, I think there's better ways to tell the story between those two to get to something else after this, to like have Swerve, you know, not leave him like he did before, but you lead to something where then Keith Lee appears in the Nick Wayne match. And then they have a match after that. And I feel like that's still going to happen, but it feels less earned based on what they've done there. So I like the early part with establishing Keith Lee as that guy who's going to ragdoll people across the ring, like when he first premiered, and getting people amped for that, but then, you know, not loving the end, like I just said. So a mixed bag, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you're going to have Keith Lee around, get him involved in something that matters. Having him just sort of hang out as this sort of larger than life charismatic figure with all this acclaim. And part of it is, you know, what he brought with him from WWE that limited his WWE push, which was, you know, bad cardio and just, you know, sort of an attitude that felt like he wasn't willing to work as hard and do what it took to be great in the ring, as physically he needed to make up for the aging, and the attitude issues and the physical conditioning were a disqualifier in the eyes of WWE. And in AEW, it's not like he's, I'm going to prove them wrong. He came in and going, hey, now I got another job being who I want to be right now. So that's sort of baked in now. It's been long enough. But I still would say if you're AEW, you've got him. You signed him. You know, whether you did due diligence or not, now you know what you got. Get something out of him. And I guess you could say that's what they're doing, you know, with this and the Swerve Strickland thing. You can't really trust him to be in a singles main event match anymore. You know, I don't think you can, you know, of any kind of length and expect it to hold together. That's not, you know, this is not the Keith Lee of 6 years ago. So, you know, this is probably the way to get the most out of him, but yeah, I don't know. You know, I mean, you should try to get something out of him. And I guess this is at this point, and tag matches seem to be the best thing for him at this point too. But you know, I think we're probably headed, well, we'll see where we're headed. Could be six-man tags with Lee, Cassidy, and I don't know. This is an Eliminator tournament. Things are random, so it doesn't necessarily mean it'll carry over past that. Do I think there's anything else in your notes, Tyler, that you want to bring up?
No, I think we talked about there's five matches. I think we talked about all of them. I mean, I think a critique, at least we got a while from the live viewers on the YouTube show last week, is that there's a lot of talking on last week's Dynamite, and obviously the same thing here. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I've enjoyed the a little slower feeling pace and the, like you brought up tonight, the videos to set up Collision and then to set up the main event. You know, that seems to be a more regular thing that you can expect watching Dynamite and Collision to a lesser extent. But, you know, I think promos, talking, storytelling, framing things are important aspects of pro wrestling. And if you want to, you know, add any sort of, you know, audience, I think you need to frame stories in that way and not just have all action. There's a reason when you watch, let's say you're watching a UFC pay-per-view, you know, there's a lot, there's more buildup in the vignettes than there is, you know, if you have a championship match, it can go up to 25 minutes. But before that, there's vignettes and people talking and an analysis and podcasts and things like that, that build up in 3X, 5X, 10X the time you actually watch the fight to build it up and make it feel important. So I think all sort of combat sports, real or simulated, need to have that aspect and not just have match, 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 because that's what separates, you know, under prelim matches versus main event matches is the story, the framing, the characters. So I'll get off my soapbox there.
Well, no, that's good. The last thing I want to bring up, just Wheeler Yuta. How did he do and how did Kenny look in the actual main event of this show? And, you know, we got about 12 minutes, I think, of action between them. I know I had my disagreement with the framing of Yuta's pre-match attack. It's nothing new, unfortunately. We see that too often, although I thought they were creative earlier in the show where the bell rang and the wrestlers, whoever it was, weren't ready yet and they got attacked and that was sort of their fault. But anyway, match quality-wise, what do you think of this? And did Yuta – it was Yuta's best promo to date. The vignette that he did talking about the match. Kenny seemed to be in a good spot physically and demeanor wise. And they, you know, went out there and had a good match that was more a vehicle to just lead to the angle afterwards. What are your thoughts on what they did with that 15 or so minutes?
Yep. I thought it was good, solid, TV main event match, you know, right where you want to be to not, you know, give everything away. I think it's important to have good main event matches, but, you know, have a Kenny and Will Ospreay type match on pay-per-view and then have this sort of match on TV, I think is a good cadence for his character and especially just for his health, to not be, you know, dropped on his neck every match would be ideal. So that was good. And Yuta fills that role, you know, that Danny Garcia role as well, depending if you need that good worker that's going to eat the pin. But yeah, I would say the one critique on Yuta that I still have is, especially near the end of the match, like his selling can be a little goofy for me at times, like where he's, you know, standing up straight and kind of like a, you know, a Looney Tunes cartoon character, like spinning around with like the things above his head. It's just a little bit of things to break. And I think, you know, like a Moxley wouldn't do something like that, but, and then Kenny on a positive side, but Yuta I think is great and great in that role. And he's a good worker. You know what you're going to get out of him. And I think he's on the upper third of work rate in that company, which is saying something. So I think he's a valuable asset. And, you know, I don't know what his long-term trajectory would be, but, you know, when you're main eventing against Kenny Omega on AEW, you're handpicked by Tony Khan to do that role. And that's definitely an upgrade over, you know, even if you look at the pandemic, he was an alternate for the Ring of Honor pure title tournament. And he didn't even compete in that tournament because he was literally an alternate. They had him come to the hotel during quarantine and sit there and not wrestle. So to go 3 years from that to wrestling Kenny Omega in the main event on cable television is pretty good, I would say. But and then just one positive thing on Kenny, I enjoy his selling of, you know, doing some moves that are probably too intense for having an injury and then selling that like it's real. I think his selling on that aspect has been much improved, and much like MJF, where they can make things that you're really questioning, did he actually injure himself or is he selling on it? And then you really obviously throughout the match learn he's selling it, but you know, using that sparingly is an important thing. And I think that is a positive of Kenny's repertoire that he's added here later on in AEW.
All right. Very good. Tyler, thank you. Anything that you want to plug?
Yeah, just the YouTube page. So just search PW Torch on YouTube. You'll see Zach Haydorn, myself, and Stephanie Chase as well are the key members there. Zach and I have moved our flagship show, The Fireside Chat, to Fridays. So Fridays around 4 p.m. Eastern or 3, you know, it just depends on when both of us are available. But we talk about all the biggest news stories of the week. And obviously we're talking a lot of Money in the Bank on Friday. Plus, you know, this, a lot of these same discussions broadly about AEW you can check out there. But please give us a subscription and on YouTube and check us out there. But besides that, yeah, just keep it locked on the torch. And very exciting times. Usually summer's the dead period, but I feel like this is the most newsworthy summer in what, 25 years with all the stuff going on. So
yeah, I mean, WWF in their game with – you know, Ford Field and the London trip for two of their big events, and then AEW with All In and All Out, and we got the start of Collision. I mean, yeah, it's just it's crazy, and the numbers WWE is doing right now, they're onto something, and it doesn't mean AEW should copy them, but you know, there are things to learn and study about what's working for them that is not related just to a bunch of cash deals that are making them, you know, making them wealthy and successful on the business ledger. There's other things that are clicking, and it's you don't want to be stuck trying to battle, if you're Tony Khan, the WWE of 2016 or 2013. You know, you've got to stay current on what your competition's doing, and adjust on the fly as you go, because they're having a lot of success. But you know, AEW's got a big advance for that All In show, but they have some, I talked about on the Wade Keller Hotline, the focus on AEW edition earlier this week, the attendance figures for some of their shows are not good. And this TD Garden show is going to be a real test of their drawing power in a major market when they are struggling and a lot of others to even hit, you know, the 3,000 mark and on some of these shows in terms of attendance, while WWE is doing, you know, much better in similar markets. So, yeah, I mean, anyway, whole other topic than Dynamite, so we'll pause there and pick it up in some other show. But Tyler, great talking with you. Always fun doing shows with you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And thanks to our callers and emailers, and of course to our listeners. And we'll talk to you all next time.